All right.
Welcome back to Healing the Earth Radio here in Guelph. And I have on the air with me Velka Ripper. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thank you kindly for coming on. And it's been about a year since I last saw you in Guelph here for the film festival. I'm pretty happy to have you back on in a way. And So I wonder if you want to introduce... I introduced you a bit about Scared Sacred, a bit about the story, and I wonder if you can maybe introduce listeners to this recent film project that's being screened across Canada, and tell us about what it's about.
Sure. A little bit about what Scared Sacred is all about?
Yeah. Just
sure.
Kind of your story in making it as well would be great.
Uh-huh. It's a long story. The film took 5 years to make, and it's based on my journey to what I've come to call the ground zeros of the world. Places like Bhopal, post 9/11 New York, Bosnia, Hiroshima, Israel and Palestine, and Afghanistan, searching for stories of hope or possibility, stories of people taking action in the face of these great crises, stories of people finding pathways to survival, even transformation. And that's what I was really searching for. And you know, in the course of making the film, of course, I went to probably 30 different ground zeros, as well as to the places of pilgrimage, the holy places of the world.
Mm. And what kind of places affected you most? Because I know you went to some pretty sites of extreme devastation.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, every place had a different kind of impact on me. I think one of the most difficult places was really going to Israel and Palestine, just because the conflict is so entrenched. And any time you talk about reasons or motivations, you go say, well, this happened, you know, people will say, well, this happened last year, this happened 5 years ago, well, this happened 100 years ago, well, this happened 1,000 years ago. And the layers of, you know, the layers upon layers that are built up there are so hard to extricate. And I think often people get very confused by what's going on there. And there's so much spin from all sides. So that was a place where even when I went through, the customs officer said to me, you know, well, you're looking for hope here? Like, good luck, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was also the place where I was shot at by the Israeli army when I was filming the security wall in Palestine, a little town called Qalqilia, which is completely encircled now by this great fence, which is not really a fence. It's a huge wall that's, you know, really turned this town and it's turning Palestine into like one big concentration camp. So anyways, I was shot at there, and at that point I really had to question, you know, I had a visceral understanding of what the people there were living through every day, and I had a visceral sense of, I had to question myself, what would I do, you know, if, you know, one of my friends had been shot, or my child had been shot. You know, what if I had a child? What would I have done? And then I went out and I met this incredible group called the Bereaved Family Circle. And you know, there are some of the most profound individuals I've met. They're both Israelis and Palestinians whose children have been killed in the conflict, and yet instead of choosing to strike back, which is one of the first things, you know, when you've been shot at, you know, that's one of your first impulses. It's a human impulse, I guess, you know, shoot back. But instead of choosing that path, the path of vengeance, they've chosen, somehow found within their hearts, the ability to choose this path of reconciliation. So they've formed a peace group, and it's remarkable work. Like they have something called Hello Peace, which is just a phone line between Israelis and Palestinians, where anyone can pick up a phone, dial *611, and immediately be connected through a chat line with someone from the other side. And it's just, they say it's just a way of starting a dialogue. And they've had something like 300,000 people speak since the line was set up.
That's pretty amazing. That's pretty amazing for sure. I'm curious to know if you can tell us a bit about what led you to go on this journey. Because most people try to shy away from this, don't want to read about it in the papers, and certainly wouldn't want to go there. But you seem to step in the face
right.
of this courage.
Why do I go to these places? That, you know, the kind of anti-tourist
yeah.
tour.
Yeah.
The world. Well, it was, for me, it was like time traveling. I believe the world is going into a time of great crisis. We're in a place that, you know, John Amasi called the great turning, or Future of Capra called the turning point. I think many people in many different cultures have identified this as a real time of great turmoil and change in the world. You know, we could be facing an ice age. We could be facing huge climactic changes. We don't know. But we do know, and we're seeing signs now, that we're going into a time of crisis. So for me, going to these places where crisis had already happened on this vast scale was like time traveling into a future we might all be facing to some extent in various, you know, in various levels. And so going to these places, as a documentary filmmaker, my role is to go to these places and find, come back with stories that can help us in our, you know, in what we might face in our own lives. So in that sense, it's looking for tools and teachings that I could bring back to apply to a future that was looking more and more, as in the words of the Chinese, looks like we're entering into interesting times.
Mm-hmm. Can you share with us, or maybe talk a bit about what kind of tools and teachings you feel you've gathered that have meant something to you?
Sure. Well, there's many. I think one of the very concrete practices, and this is a practice that I applied while going to these ground zeros, is something I learned in the Tibetan refugee camps in the monasteries, and it's called Tonglen. It means sending and receiving. And it's the idea of, and it's mentioned explicitly in Scared Sacred, it's the idea of breathing in suffering and breathing out compassion. The idea is that, you know, on your in-breath, you can start with an individual, and you can go out to a community, you can go out to the world if you like, or you can start, but you start with a single person you know who's suffering, and you imagine breathing in all their suffering in the form of a black smoke, drawing it into your heart. And when it reaches your heart, it dissolves in a flash, and you send it back out as compassion. So you don't hold on to the suffering, instead you transform it into compassion, and that in turn can become compassionate action in the ideal sense. So that is a very concrete practice, and I used it in each place I went. Because I'd chosen to go to these places, so there was no point in going there and blocking myself off or shutting myself down. At the same time, the magnitude of the suffering I was encountering could flatten me, could bowl me over completely. So this practice actually gave me a tool, a way of dealing with a concrete tool for dealing with the suffering I encountered.
It's like a survival skill.
It's like a transformation skill. It's like aerating the suffering in some ways and giving you something to do with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just, and especially when it transforms into action, this is why so many of the people that I met, their responses to the crisis was to take action. Mm-hmm. Even the act of telling their stories was incredibly healing for them. I think it's when we become paralyzed by the crises in our life or fall into a pit of despair, you know, one of the things that I learned repeatedly from the survivors was that we have, at a certain point, everything can be taken away from you, absolutely everything, except for this one fundamental thing which you always own, and that is your choice of how you are going to respond to whatever comes your way. Also one of the last lines of the film.
I like that. That reminds me of something that Joanna Macy said, and this is said among a few other people I know of too, is that it's not so much pain that will kill us, but it's the avoidance or resistance to that pain. And I wonder if you can maybe talk about your experience or your relationship with that insight after being to all these, you know, ground zeros. Like, because you certainly didn't try to avoid this pain, but rather you kind of let it immerse you, and you came out the other side of that. And I wonder what that quote means to you.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you mentioned Joanna Macy, because she does very parallel work to what I do. And it's she calls it despair and empowerment work. And she, you know, she's based her life around teaching these amazing workshops, which really enables people to open up to really what's going on, to really feel what's going on. I think that's very true. I think you can find that on all levels of life. The stuff we block, the stuff we turn away from, does not go away. You know, that we're only fooling ourselves if we think we can turn our back on particularly this huge global crisis. It's like an elephant is running towards us down the road, and we're going to stick our heads in the sand. It's not going to work. The elephant's going to run over us either, either way. So I think that turning and facing it and looking for tools to keep us, you know, in a state of empowerment and hope is absolutely vital.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about what spiritual activism means to you? And, like, what do you see being a spiritual activist to look like?
Mm-hmm. I think it looks different for everybody. From my perspective, most of my life I've had these two sides to me, to the way I operate. I've had my activist side, and really that's how I started making films was as an activist. I was an activist first, and then I started making films. And then I've had this other side, which has been my spiritual side, you know, the side of me that meditates and is looking, you know, looking to the higher possibilities in some way. But these were two very separate things. But I think that now what I think is now happening today is that the spiritual people are thinking, well, you know, well, I've been omened, they've been bombing. And the where at the same time the activists are finding that, you know, the magnitude of what they're facing is causing burnout, that they're often so busy concentrating on what they're against that they forget to really ask, what is it that I'm really for? And I think they need a depth of meaning to their actions. So I think that both sides have part of the puzzle, and it needs to come together and integrate. So it just seems really logical, and it's very exciting to me to find that there are many other people that are starting to come to this realization. I was just at a conference in Berkeley for the Network of Spiritual Progressives, and it's really, really quite an exciting movement that's being born. There were supposed to be 300 people at the conference. We ended up with 1,200 and had to turn like 400 people away. And there were all these remarkable luminaries, like people like Arun Gandhi, which is Gandhi's grandson, Matthew Fox, Friedrich Capra, Rabbi Michael Lerner, Mubarak Awad of the Palestinian Center for Nonviolence. Just, you know, hundreds of amazing, amazing people, all talking about this need to integrate spirit and action. It just, I think it's really what is part of being a whole human being, to bring those two things together. But before we go any further, though, we probably need to define spirituality. That's one of the most misunderstood words out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's so laden with baggage with so many people. We get confused, I think, with our own history. We tie it in with religion. Religion, I think, is a finger that's pointing to something. And often we just stare at the finger and we forget about where it's pointing. So spirituality to me is rooted in the sense of the sacred, the sense of awe and wonder, or what can be called radical amazement. And I think when you look at the world and see the truly awesome quality of this universe that we live in, and you really get in touch with that, your whole sense of priority shift. If you look at things from as sacred, your sense of economics immediately is changed. The bottom line is no longer how much can we extract, how much profit can we make, but you know the bottom line becomes, you know, how would I treat this in a sacred way, as a sacred, something sacred, you know. So everything starts shifting when you see things as sacred.
Hmm. I like that Eduardo Galeano line. It's not what you look at, it's what you see.
Uh-huh.
And we can all
exactly.
Look at the same things. We can see
that's
something.
Another thing we have. We're so trapped in what can be called pattern recognition. You know, we don't even see anything anymore. We just see our cultural preconceptions, our filters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Perhaps, can you talk a bit about this trilogy you're working on? I didn't realize
sure.
until today that Scared Sacred is just part one of a trilogy.
That's right. And as with Scared Sacred, which will also eventually be a book, and it began as a website, Fierce Light is the name of part two of the Scared Sacred trilogy. And it's going to be launching next week on rabble.ca, www.rabble.ca/radio. And it's part of the Rabble Podcast Network. And so it's going to be a podcast first, and then it's going to be a film, and then it's going to be a book. The subject of part two of the Scared Sacred trilogy is spiritual activism, just what we've been talking about. So I'll be very concretely exploring that. and looking for stories of spiritual activism around the world, some of which has already been shot, and some to be shot. I'll be going to South America, probably to Africa, and maybe to one other country, so a continent. So places that I haven't been to in Scared Sacred. Mm. And then the third in the trilogy is called Evolve Dissolve, and it's about the notion that this global crisis that we're facing could become an opportunity for a leap in human consciousness. And that's my tremendous, I have this tremendous sense of optimism that the crises that we're facing, you know, like, you know, during the first week of New Orleans, you know, one of the things that came out of that was that George Bush's approval ratings plummeted, you know. So if that's not hope, I don't know what is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do think that the global crisis is in that sense, it was like it stripped the Katrina, like stripped away the facade of America's, and revealed that it was the vast inequity of between the rich and the poor, and the fact that the poor there were basically abandoned, the rich had already been evacuated, and you know that revealed it. So I think that the crises that we're facing are going to start to reveal some realities that maybe we've been able to avoid, and give us an opportunity, to have a sense of urgency, and that sense of urgency can impel us to wake up.
Mm.
And that's the final theme of that's the final of the trilogy, which will also be a book and a web project and a film.
Yeah, that sounds incredible.
Should be done by the whole kit and caboodle should be done by 2012.
I hope so. I hope it's done before then, and I hope things are you know.
That we still have a planet.
I sincerely hope so. I'm curious to know what you're thinking about this, or what you hope for this leap in consciousness.
For what?
For this leap in consciousness you mentioned about the film Evolve and Dissolve.
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. What would this leap in consciousness look like?
Yeah.
Well, that's part of what the film will be exploring. You know, what does that mean to wake up?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would a society, you know, that was awake, what would an awake society look like? You know, I think that it will be some things, the leap in consciousness, some things will be unimaginable to us. I think that we'll find, I think community and collectivity will become a big part of that. I think that group mind is one possible element of a leap. I think that, you know, really the ability to really integrate consciousness in some way. At the same time, you know, maintaining individuality as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some of the basic principles that are enshrined in human rights, you know, codes would be enacted, you know, just naturally. You know, everything would just be natural, coming from a place of compassion, seeing each face as your own. So really intrinsically sensing and feeling and acting from a place of interconnectedness would be very central to a leap in consciousness. And, of course, living sustainably on the Earth, so there'd be a biocentric focus.
Mm-hmm.
And recognizing, you know, again, that just as humans are interconnected, the entire web of life is a multidimensional matrix that in which you can't separate anything. So in that sense, you have a responsibility to care for every aspect of this universe. I mean, there's many possibilities. And we might see, you know, inklings of possibility in the participatory democracy movement that's happening in, you know, particularly in South America right now. I'll be going there looking for some of those, you know, what's going on with the World Social Forum. Wonder what that will look like in 20 or 30 years. So there's, you know, that's the sort of, I'll be looking for some of those cutting-edge experiments where people are trying to live from a more awakened place.
Hmm. I like that.
Good question.
Yeah. And a lot of the things you mentioned have been explored with, you know, indigenous communities for thousands of years, which is almost like we're just getting back on track now as a wholeness of humanity, like as far as the group mind and, like, the radical intuition. And all this kind of consciousness. it's pretty interesting to see how that would play out on a global scale.
Yeah, it's going to be, these are really interesting times. I mean, the thing is that we are now living in a time of exponential change, which is very hard to get your head around. Mm-hmm. Exponential change is not the same as just, you know, 1 year changing the next. These are like changes doubling, quadrupling, you know, you know. So it gets faster and then faster and then faster, faster, faster. So we are going to witness, you know, such phenomenal change in the next, you know, 20, 30 years on so many different levels. And then, you know, it's a real honor to be born at this time in history.
Mm-hmm.
We're born into a time of absolute transition and possibility. And so I think that every single one of us has a role to play, you know, to be born now. And it's up to us to find out what our role is and to act on that. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have something on a global scale. It could be just something that happens in your own block, in your own home, you know, some way that you're able to align yourself with the evolution that's happening, the evolutionary imperative.
Yeah, it's truly an exciting time. It's so exciting. A few more questions, I'm curious. Well, actually, I'm wondering if you could maybe tell us a bit about a story, perhaps. The story you wrote in the book, We Are Everywhere, about the people who basically built a village, or created a village atop a dam. And I found that story really inspiring. I wonder if you could share a bit about that with us.
Sure, and that actually, that story will be in Fierce Light.
Oh, yeah?
In the film, yeah.
Great.
And in the book as well. And it's the story, it's in Thailand, and it's a group of villagers, and they were people whose land was flooded by a World Bank funded dam project. And they one group of them stormed the dam that had been built and flooded their land and took it over and moved their entire village onto the top of this dam, you know, with pigs and chickens and old people and, you know, and thatch roof huts. And they created what they call the Mother Moon Peach Village number one. And there it was on top of a dam, 3,000 villagers. And it was very hard for the authorities to remove them. And then it spread. It spread to another dam down below. And then other people built a village floating on the floodwaters above their village. They call it Water World. And then there was an encampment in Bangkok as well. So it just built into this huge protest movement. And one of the dams, they succeeded in getting one of the dams decommissioned. So they were actually successful in one case. So it was it's just a tremendous grassroots story of resistance. These are mostly Buddhist villagers. But it became like an autonomous zone with people from all over the world coming to these protest villages and staying in workshops and solidarity, and you know, there was an interfaith caravan when I was there. So it's quite an inspiring story. The activism in Thailand is really taking off. It's been quite phenomenal. The Assembly of the Poor is spread all over Thailand. They have an average of 200 to 300 demonstrations a year.
Wow.
There's another story that's also in the film from Thailand.
Yeah.
And it's another spiritual activist story. In Thailand, the loggers are all Buddhists. And so what the monks have discovered is that if they ordain a tree that's about to be cut down, they wrap it in saffron robes and do a ceremony over it, that tree is officially a monk. And so the loggers can't cut it down. So these monks have gone all over Thailand and have ordained 2 million trees. And they've really effectively shut down the logging of the old-growth forests in Thailand.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
it's a great
beautiful story. I went to one of these tree
ordinances. A couple more things I'm curious to know about. Can you tell us a bit about what's going on with Scared Sacred right now? Like a screening in a couple places across Canada. And maybe tell us about you know, what you've been learning from the screenings and the reviews and the audience reactions and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really an exciting time for Scared Sacred. We're just about to do our national theatrical launch. So we started off in Vancouver, and it's played there for almost 5 weeks, and it's really had a smash opening, and we got great reviews. And that, we don't have a distributor, so we're doing this ourselves. So that enabled us to raise funds to do a national launch. And now on Friday, October 21st, Scared Sacred opens in Toronto at Canada Square Theatre in the Camera, in Calgary at the Plaza, and it's held over and reopening in Vancouver at the Van East Cinema. as well as it'll be playing in theaters across Canada. It's playing right now in 9 different provinces. So it's been really exciting to see it actually moving into the movie theaters. And if you're listening and you want to tell people to go on the website, scaredsacred.org, and forward the information to anyone you know who's in Toronto, or go yourself, especially on the opening weekend. Because opening weekend is when on Monday they decide if your film gets to continue for another week or not. For Canadian films, often a 1 week run is considered good, you know. So it's really hard to keep going. And so far we've been pulling it off, so it's been really exciting. And then in terms of audience reactions, I mean, that's been a big part of what's been going on the last year. You know, I've been touring with the film all over the world. I just came back from Iceland last weekend. I think the most moving story was in Ireland at the Dublin International Film Festival. And there was this young man who was who put up his hand after the screening, and he said that he was from Northern Ireland. And he said all his life he's carried around this deep-seated hatred for the Protestants. It's just how he was raised. But it felt like a burden to him. And after watching the film, for the first time, he felt that reconciliation was possible. And the audience applauded, and, you know, we were teary-eyed. It was really quite, really moving. So that was quite incredible to hear those, you know, those kind of responses. I also heard somebody who's been, who just had become handicapped. They lost all their faculties and for a year, and they really had been into a real state of despair. And I guess after watching the film, they said that you know, they felt their inspiration coming back, and that there was hope. So, you know, just these personal stories have been so moving for me, and it's really, you know, this is why, you know, for me, the personal journey myself was transformative. And the people I met were so inspiring, and I'm just really glad that that's being passed on and people are able to pick up on that.
I wonder if you have anything else you'd like to share with people about what people would like, what you'd like people to take from this film, and if you want to share any further stories of hope. Just kind of a closing thing, if you want.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess my favorite line is not in the film, and if you were at the Q&A in Guelph, I probably said it, I'm not sure how I'm going to work. Maybe it doesn't need to be in the film because I say it all the time anyway. But it's by Professor Cornel West, and he talks about the difference between hope and optimism. And he says that optimism is based on the facts. Looks pretty good out there. Things are going to get better. Whereas hope says it doesn't look good at all, but we're going to take the leap of faith to create new visions based on possibilities that become contagious, to encourage people to engage in heroic actions, always against the odds, no guarantee whatsoever, that's hope. And that really sums it up for me.